Oh, for close totalitarian society, you ever heard of the American House
No.
exhibit? Oh yeah,
Oh,
so
in 1950, not that one.
yeah, that they showed all
Late
a
50s.
modern American house and had like
Oh, yeah, of
three or
course,
four
yeah.
million people come through it. So for this
Right,
closed society that absolutely nothing's allowed in or out, and then you set up an exhibit of American,
Was that
technology.
wasn't that exhibition staged at Verdun Car? Wasn't it
Yeah,
in the early
it
days of
was.
Verdun
It
Car?
was.
Yeah. I was
And it
there.
lasted for.
I was at Verdun Car 3 4 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. You sure let me know. I come say hi.
Oh, you're in Moscow, are you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fine, right.
So next time, let me know.
Yeah, sure. Do that, yeah, sure.
I'll be quite happy to come meet you. Yeah, and it lasted for several months. They were talking about 3 or 4 million people went to see it. So
Right.
for a closed society, when you allow some, which in the 1950s, the U.S. was already, the number one geopolitical opponent, and they
Yeah, of
allowed
course,
some of that.
there was a major kind of opening up of Soviet society after Stalin's death in 1953. Although a lot of this, I mean, there was this kind of idea that in the late Stalin period, like late 40s, early 50s, the Soviet Union was a very isolated kind of place. I don't think that's actually true. Actually, there was quite a lot of openness in that period as well. But certainly what is true after Stalin's death, yeah, it becomes much more open in terms of its contacts with the outside world, particularly the West. And yeah, and this kitchen, the American House, this is the one where Nixon is this where Nixon visits it, doesn't it? Is this the same place? And they have like him and Khrushchev have the so-called the kitchen debate. That's the place. So that, yeah, sure.
There's something else that nobody really talks about. Stalin tried to organize an ecumenical council in Moscow back about 1951. He had the patriarch of, because he reinstated a patriarchy, and he had the patriarch go in and try to organize an ecumenical council of Orthodox churches in Moscow, and turn the Soviet Union into the epicenter of Orthodoxy. He failed because the Greek churches, Athens, Constantinople, at that point, Antioch, Alexandria, they were all under the CIA, and the CIA said, no way in hell you're going up to the Soviet Union for an ecumenical council. So that fell through. But yeah, he and Sergei Posad, which was the throne of the patriarchy, that there was only one church left in 22 June 1941 that was getting ready to be demolished. And from what people are saying, Stalin had a come to Jesus moment. He got scared. And because I mean, he had been in seminary, he was supposed to become a priest. And then after that, the Sergei Posad was rebuilt using the Komsomolsk. They were encouraged to go rebuild the churches. So that's something that's not very often said. I'm not saying he became an overly religious man, but maybe he did. I don't know what's in his mind.
And I'm just not. I don't buy this line that that Stalin found Jesus again. Ever. I
Who
don't get
knows?
that. I don't know.
Who
Well,
knows?
I think I know. The evidence says complete the contrary that he didn't. So it's pure speculation. But it's interesting you say about his effort to establish this ecumenical council of the yeah. But that's an example of like outreach to the outside world, right? There's a and that's like you said, 1951. Yeah, there's another thing that goes
In
on. That's
1951 and 1952, it was right before his death.
In 1952, there's a big like world like economic conference that the Soviet stage in Moscow, right? Kind of business kind of thing, yeah, where they're trying to develop business links for various Western companies, right?
Oh,
There's a
yeah.
lot of stuff that I know about going on in relation to the peace movement, yeah, because you get this massive peace movement develops internationally from the late 1940s onwards, right? And that spawns various kind of like connections between peace activists and peace organizations all over the world, including, of course, the Soviet Union being at the very center. So there's a lot, this supposedly isolationist period of late Stalinism, that's the image people have it. There's actually a lot going on in terms of the Soviet Union's connections with the outside world. But at the same time, it's still true to say that there is a there's much more relaxation and much more openness after Stalin dies, for sure.
You know, there was even a case. Stalin awarded Hero of the Soviet Union, the civilian version, to 17 priests in St. Petersburg, who held their churches open because they kept morale up in Leningrad as it was under siege.
Right.
There was a lot of, you know, I think a lot of the certain levels of repression, anyways, faded away very quickly when the war started.
Yeah, well, of course, during the Second World War, there's this big reconciliation between, Stalin and the Orthodox Church. And not just
the church bought a battalion of tanks.
Religion in general, wasn't just the Orthodox Church. I mean, there was a different policy towards all other religions, Islam and so on. Yeah, yeah, obviously, it's part of the Great Patriotic War, the mobilization of the Great Patriotic War. So there's a new kind of like relationship that develops, and that continues after the war and continues, well, right away until the end of the Soviet regime. Because look, Khrushchev rediscovered his militant atheism from time to time, and there were some repressive measures under him. Yeah.
Yeah, the church even bought the Alexander Nevsky Battalion. The church gathered money, bought a battalion of tanks, of T-34s. Khrushchev, interestingly enough, when Khrushchev was removed by the Politburo, one of the points that they removed him for was excess pressure on the church. He'd gone overboard. Okay. His Milton atheism.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. I actually haven't, that hadn't occurred to me, because obviously you think about Khrushchev's removal to do with like his relationships with other members of the leadership, which is very poor, it's very domineering.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's to do with the disruptions of some of his economic reforms, which didn't turn out very well. And people argue that what some people saw as a retreat in relation to the Cuban situation, the Cuban missile crisis. But I've never heard that point about the,
I mean,
it makes absolute sense that would be part of the indictment of Khrushchev.
Yeah. It was a pretty long indictment.
Khrushchev's departure, of course, is very important from my point of view, or from Zhukov's point of view, because it's post-Khrushchev that Zhukov is rehabilitated as a great Soviet war hero.
Yeah. And he deserves it. I mean, starting with the fight with the Japanese. Nobody seems to remember that either. Mongolia. Which, I mean, if you think about that fight in Mongolia, which, while the Japanese didn't take giant casualties, I think there were like 50,000 KIA, that changed the entire course of the war. Because the Southern Party won, and they went south to expand the empire instead of going to Siberia.
I mean, it's I mean, I think in general, the problem with the northern strategy, Japanese strategy, was, which is a kind of expansion in the Soviet direction, and also in China, was that the Chinese war hadn't gone very well for the Japanese. Yes, been very and I think Halkin-Gol, Zhukov's victory at Halkin-Gol on the Mongolian border with Manchuria, reinforced that message, the immense difficulties of expansion in the northern direction, as opposed to, the southern strategy of seizing control of Southeast Asia and, obviously attacking the American fleet at Pearl Harbor and so on.
Yeah, Hagen Goals, by the way, the first time the T-34 came into actual combat action.
Right.
It scared the crap out of the Japanese. They had nothing they could stop them with. They had light tanks.
It was a great victory, but the enemy wasn't necessarily
They were suicidally brave, throw themselves underneath the tank to blow it up, but that only has a limited effect. It gets an entire tank battalion with infantry mounted. And the Japanese tanks at that point were extremely light. They were basically tankettes, a little upgraded, the French tankettes from World War One. They just slightly upgraded machine gun tanks. Mark Ones, Mark Twos, German. Right. So Panzer Kampfwagen. Right. So the Japanese never were good at building tanks back then. They
They're pretty good at building cars nowadays.
Yes. And very good
many
planes.
Other things. Everything else, yes.
The Zero was a very good plane. But the tanks were just... Well, you know what was interesting was the German super submarines, the transport submarines, when Americans started running into German 88s in Japanese on Japanese islands,
Right.
lighting them up. They were disassembling these and shipping them in large enough numbers
Right.
to the
Okay.
Japanese.
Right. Okay. I'm very good. The anti-aircraft gun you're talking about, yes?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was original anti-aircraft gun, but man, that was the
Sure.
best
Yeah.
cannon in the
Yeah.
entire war.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
So,
An anti-tank weapon as well, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
anti-tank, it became a tank gun. They
Yeah.
just
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
remounted, the Germans remounted on the mounted on their Panzers or
Right.
Panthers.
Yeah. Sure.
The Panther had the 88
You see,
mag.
I do know something about,
Yeah.
the technology. It's coming back into my mind. Yes.
The problem when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, they were bad enough trying to fight the first model of the T-34s. When the KV-1s came out, that was it. The only thing that could take on a KV-1 was an 88, and by the time you mounted the 88, there's nothing left of that 88
Right,
because
yeah.
it was in the anti-aircraft mode. You
Yeah,
had to
sure.
bring it up, tow it up, put it, get them out. And meanwhile, the T-30, the KV-1 is looking at it and opening fire on it,
Right.
so
Yeah,
or just
sure.
driving right over it. So those were monster tanks. I mean, just gigantic monster tanks. Have you ever read anything about German tank construction in World War One?
No. No, I haven't. Sorry.
There's a reason for that. It almost didn't exist. Achtung
World War One, you
Panzer,
said, yes. Yeah.
Guderian's Achtung Panzer is very worth reading, as he goes over these battles on
Only in the First World War.
First World War. The Germans, I'm gonna tell you exactly how many tanks the Germans built. Now, these were those giant land tanks that were like 11-man crew that looked like a ship. They built 47 tanks.
Right.
And they captured another 45 Mark IIs and then French tanks that they repurposed and resent. So they had a whole tank force of under 100 tanks through the whole
Right.
war. Right, and the high command came out with, "Our soldiers are brave; they'll figure it out." And the Western Allies built between the different British Mark ones, Mark twos, and then the tankettes from all different sizes. They built like 5,000 tanks
Right.
against a
Quite a
hundred.
lot. Yeah. I didn't realize that they produced that many
Oh yeah.
in the First
I
World War.
mean, some of these, a large number of them were tankettes, where you had a two-man
Yeah.
crew, basically a machine gunner. And a driver, and the machine gunner was standing. There wasn't even a place for him to sit down.
Sure. Yeah.
Those are French tankettes, but against rifles, they're pretty damn effective. So
Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
yeah, it's a book worth reading. It's a very interesting book, just as a history book of World War One,
Yeah.
the final battles.
I have to say I haven't read it. Obviously, I know about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good work. It definitely should be in everybody's library if you're studying military history.
Right.
Because that's what it was meant, teach the Germans that, hey, it didn't work the first time. We don't need to do this the second time the same
Right,
way. They take a
yeah.
different path. So, well, what do you think? I mean, lately, there's just been big drive to try to drive Stalin out of the history period. It's the Soviet people. It was, as if the whole country just organized itself without any leadership. And then trying to emphasize that, yeah, Stalin was in depression for the first 2 months, things like that.
I haven't particularly, you're talking about in Russia, are you?
No, in the West. And Russia's is going quite the opposite direction these days. So.
I hadn't particularly noticed that myself. It'd be quite, it's quite a different, difficult thing to do. No, I mean, I would say that, Stalin, yeah, remains a central figure, but specifically in relation to the Second World War. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier, okay, you talk about in your introduction, Stalin's Wars and the controversial book and stuff like that. Well, I think that was true at the time, but actually, it's not so true these days because, okay, the book was published 20 odd years ago, yeah, 2006, yeah, 20 years ago. But now it's kind of like it's central kind of like narrative and argument, that Stalin was actually quite an effective war leader. And we can actually demonstrate this through the actual story of the war from his perspective and the function of the Soviet High Command and all the battles and so on. Right? that kind of argument of mine, okay, it wasn't my, only me put that argument, other, it's quite generally accepted, yeah? Okay, it's grudging acceptance by a lot of people, but the idea that, well, in a very real sense, you know, Stalin was a great war leader, is, I think, you know, I'd almost say that's the consensus now. Now, of course, people also say, you know, he was also a great monster, some people say. Or he was a great, he was a dictator, and, you know, and you know, there would be, he might have been effective during the war, but he was ineffective in other things. So there's certainly, obviously, there's an argument about Stalin. But certainly in terms of his reputation as a war leader, I would say it's still riding pretty high. And okay, some people might want to write him out of the story, but it's completely impossible to do, given what the Second World War was and what actually happened. You know?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you've read into any archival documents on this, but from what I've read and what at least in some of the scholarly works, Stalin in 1948, as NATO is being formed, Stalin asked to join NATO to set up a European peace structure, which, by the way, interesting enough, Nicholas II was the one that first started pushing for a League of Nations and a comprehensive European peace structure. So, you know, from the 1880s. And that didn't quite work out, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's a very interesting point. Yeah. Well, actually, you can take it back further. That you can go back to, you know, Alexander the First. Yeah. You can go further back.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, okay. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. In fact, I'm kind of like writing an article about that very topic. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But in terms of what you said about the NATO business, yeah. Now, okay. Now, well, of course, what happened was that it wasn't Stalin, it was actually Molotov. Molotov, mm-hmm, in 1954 made a proposal on behalf of the Soviet government that if NATO was a defensive organization, like it claimed, then the Soviet Union would be interested in becoming a member of that organization. Okay, and the proposal is like pitched in the form of, you know, at that time, you know, the Soviet Union, Molotov, had a campaign for European collective security, right? For a common European collective security space, which, by the way, is still, you know, the position of the Russian government. So it was part of that. So the idea was, you know, Soviet Union can join NATO. We can have this collective security, common collective security organization, which the United States could be a part of, right? And then we'd have, like, well, okay, a common European, a new kind of structure of security, you know. So that's it. That's in 1954. Now, but there were precedents for that. Is that even when Stalin was still alive, the Soviets were saying, "Well, what, you know, maybe we should join NATO." Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and including, I think there is one statement by Stalin to that effect. But it's not until 1954, after Stalin's death, that the Soviets actually make a formal proposal that the Soviet Union should join NATO. And of course, if we jump forward to post-Soviet times, it's very definitely the case that Russia, post-Soviet Russia, was interested, very interested in the possibility of becoming a member of NATO, but only on the basis of being a kind of like an equal and full partnership, you know, between Russia and the West, right? They weren't interested in becoming a subordinate, you know, within the NATO structures. And of course, the whole project of, you know, a common European collective security system, that project continues to be pursued by Russia in post-Soviet times. Now, currently, I mean, Putin has started talking less about European security and more about Eurasian security. So apparently Putin's thinking is that what you need is Eurasian, mm-hmm, pan-Eurasian, pan-European Asian security structures, not just European ones. But what that means in practice, in detail, is not clear.
Yeah, it's sad that, you know, for even if you don't take Alexander the First and post-Napoleon, and just even if you just start with Nicholas II, that's already 140 years trying to establish a peace structure for Europe.
Yeah,
if we could have avoided World War I, my God, the history I'm not even going to talk World War II, but just World War I, there's just been an entirely radical, different development of humanity.
And the interesting thing, of course, is the question, well, why did these like Russian and Soviet and post-Soviet Russian attempts at common European security fail? How do you explain the failure? Okay, long story, but I think you explain the failure because consistently Russia is seen as being a threat, being an adversary or a potential adversary, rather than being an ally and a friend. And that's, in a sense, that's why, we're in the situation we're in today, because of this perception, that Russia in the West, that Russia is a dangerous adversary, and you can't ally with it, you can't have friendship with it, you can't be part of the same street. What you need to do, you need some way, find means of containing Russia, and preferably not just containing Russian power, but actually undermining Russian power and weakening Russia as a great power. And so, and that, so that kind of like, the current story about, well, is actually, you can trace back, I don't know, 200 years.
Oh yeah, it's kind of like if you look at German politics, the party that's the evil psychopaths are the ones that are going, "Hey, why don't we have peace and have a normal economic policy and not militarize?" Oh no, you can't have talks with the alternative future from Deutschland. They're crazies. They're crazies. They're Nazis because they want to have peace and just live a normal economic life. It's the same concept. Oh, the Russians want peace again. Damn
Sure.
it. Let's start a
Right.
war. Why? It's I looked it up real quick. I was wrong. It wasn't 1951. It was 1948. And they did have a pan-Orthodox conference, but it wasn't the Ecumenical Council because they couldn't get the Greeks in. The Greeks were already fully under the CIA, so they
Okay,
refused
that's it. Yeah, I
the
must.
different Greek church Orthodox churches. They had the Romanians, the Bulgarians,
Okay,
The
yeah.
Georgian Patriarchy, well, obviously
Yeah.
Georgian Patriarchy is part of Russia.
Thanks for that. Another thing I've learned from you today.
Yeah.
I'll check that out.
So that was an attempt. He was trying to make the Soviet Union a center of orthodoxy. Didn't
Sure.
work out. It's like, thanks, good try, but
Right. Yeah.
and history rolls on. It was because I always thought it was 48 when Stalin. So it's interesting that it was Molotov in 53.
54.
54,
Yeah,
54.
54. Yeah. Molotov was the one who, this post-Stalin, develops the idea of European collective security, a pan-European collective security system.
Yeltsin also asked, and I was talking with Colonel Wilkerson, who was chief of staff for Colin Powell, both in the military and when Powell became Secretary of State. And he said George Sr. had the George Sr. White House. They were literally looking at it as a realistic thing and bringing up plans. But one, George Bush Sr. lost the re-election, and two, Clinton with his little problem with stains on dresses and his various liaisons. He needed to look tough. So he said, that's why they deep sixed it. They needed to look tough against somebody. To get their credibility back, and who better look tough against than the Russians at the moment? So they deep sixed that whole initiative from Yeltsin.
But I think they deep sixed it, you put it, because they felt they could. They had the luxury to do it
Oh yeah,
because Russia,
absolutely.
in the 1990s was very weak. So they could treat it, in that way. So I think that.
I think George Bush Sr. had a better understanding. He was former head of the CIA. He had a better understanding of what was going on. He's, by the way, the last one that could control the Israelis too. He cut him, he quite literally cut him off from supplies as punishment.
You say that about George Senior Bush and all that, but he was the one who like originated this kind of narrative of America's victory
Oh yeah,
in Cold War.
absolutely.
I
I'm
mean,
not excusing him. I'm not a big
which the
fan of it.
foundations, which is the foundation stone of all the kind of like the very negative war strategy that the Americans pursued towards Russia after the Soviet collapse. I think also the Americans see other states in Europe as being more important than Russia. I mean, I'm in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, former Soviet bloc. That's their priority, is to develop relationships with them, and obviously ultimately to expand NATO into century. So Russia always takes second place, all along until, of course, Putin comes along and shakes things up a bit, and a more equal relationship begins to develop between Russia and NATO and Russia and the United States.
Well, toward the end of '99, I got transferred into 18th Airborne Corps headquarters, G3. I was a captain, and lo and behold, during that time, except for when we were planning the invasion of Iraq and taking Baghdad, everything was being worked out against Russia, which right. In the end is why I finally left, because I didn't want to participate in that. And up to 99, it was, I think, pretty lackadaisical, because they're like, it's going to die in its own anyways. Yeltsin's making sure it'll collapse. And then after 99, it's like, something went wrong. things suddenly start turning around. Chechnya 2 is over. And then the alarm bells start going off at that point. It's not going to plan. I don't know where George Bush Sr. would have gone with it if he had gotten reelected, but we know which way Clinton went. Was definitely the expansion of NATO and on and on and on, unfortunately. And the rest is history, and here we are.
But even so, even in the face of that treatment, and NATO expansion as it develops, there's still not just Yeltsin, but Putin was interested in developing a collaborative relationship. Including the possibility of NATO membership. I think NATO membership is definitely off the agenda now, but the idea of a collaborative relationship between Russia and the United States, it seems to me, is still central, at least central to, remain central to Putin's thinking about world politics. Now, how long that can persist, it obviously depends on how various things work out. But it's actually amazing the persistence with which Russia has pursued cooperation, collaboration with the United States. Which I think, by the way, sorry, I think it's a good thing. I'm not one of those people who criticize the Russians or Putin for doing that. What I lament is the fact that they failed. They failed in the face of Western negativity.
Absolutely. I mean, most Americans don't know that A, the Russian Empire helped them get their independence. And B, the Russian Empire was on the side of the Union during the Civil War, which may have been a mistake. I think that was more emotional at that point. Alexander II was still a little bit sore about the Crimean War 10 years earlier.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
I think if you looked further on, it would have gone, maybe we should side with the South after all. But history is history is. He was just where the British and the French will be on the other side, which is not a good way to make policy, but it is what it is, unfortunately. And you would think, I mean, like it or not, for the Europeans, Russia's 42% of Europe. By PPP, Russia's the biggest economy of Europe. It's got the biggest military force of Europe. It's got most of the resources of Europe. It's got most of the farmland of Europe. It's got the biggest population of any European country. You think you'd want normal relationships.
Absolutely. It makes complete rational sense for that to be the case. Yes.
It's what nobody talks about, Russia has, I think, the fourth or fifth largest economic manufacturing base in the world.
Right.
So it's a huge manufacturing house, too. Sure. It's not just oil and gas.
I mean, I remain hopeful, optimistic that possibility might realize itself. Obviously, at the moment, things look very negative as far as Russia's relationships with Europe is concerned. But I don't know, things can turn around very, very quickly. Political situation in Europe could turn around very quickly. If Marine Le Pen wins the French presidency in a couple of years' time, that could radically alter the geopolitics between Russia and Europe who knows? And yeah, so I'm kind of like, you know, I'm hoping that, Russia persists in its pursuit of improved relations with Europe into the future.
What about Farage? Yeah, when Brexit happened, there was a lot of hope that he'd finally be able to develop normal trade relations and everything with the UK, and they were developing. And then everything went went very bad. Any chance of a Farage change in British politics, or is it just disenfranchised Tories and same politics as before?
I think a Farage premiership, prime ministership, it would shake up British politics. Very hard to predict in what kind of direction, but certainly Farage himself, and I think the reform movement in general, doesn't kind of like share the hostility towards Russia and Putin, that kind of consensus among the establishment parties. So and also the Green Party in the UK has also its strength is increasing. They've had a very like pro-Ukrainian line in the current context, but the impression I have is that they're open to at least negotiation, at least talking to Russia, to Putin, about things of mutual benefit. Yes, and of course the new German situation, the AfD, Alternative for Deutschland. Yeah, I mean, who knows what's gonna happen there? And then other countries as well. So at the moment it's a very like pessimistic picture in terms of the current state of Russia's relationships with Europe. But it's Russia's relationships with the present like European political elite. Those who have the power at the present time. The hostility there is between Russia and Europe at the present time, I don't see that as being very deep-rooted in terms of popular sentiment. Mm-hmm. I don't see any real evidence that there's a deep-rooted hostility towards Russia among European people. Certainly there's some, which is not surprising given the kind of like the propaganda, anti-Russia propaganda that's been intensively spread in the West, particularly in the last 5 years, But there's no inherent deep reasons why the political situation in Europe can't turn around quite quickly, and that can't have beneficial effects as far as Europe's relationships with Russia are concerned. What's crucial in that regard is obviously that the war in Ukraine has to come to an end, right? That nothing's going to happen until the war ends. And also the war has to end on some kind of a negotiated basis. There has to be some kind of settlement that stabilizes the situation. That's the context in which you could get quite a radical quite a quick reconstruction of relations between Russia and Europe. If that doesn't happen, the war drags on in some form, then of course, we could be in the situation we're in now for many more years to come.
Yeah, yeah. Well, until as long as you have the more radical elements in the European Union that are in power, the Zelensky types that are making money off of this war to the very end. Unfortunately, I don't see too many things happening without an actual major move on the battlefield.
Obviously, yeah, sure, but yeah, it depends what happens on the battlefield. But I don't know. I mean, depends on your view. I mean, my view is that it depends what happens on the battlefield. Yeah, sure, that's right. But the thing about these radical elements. I mean, one of the most important things to understand the current situation is that these radical elements, as you put it, they want to see an escalation of war in Ukraine, right? And one of the things that obviously Putin and his government, they're resisting that provocation, right? My concern is that the provocation might become so intense that there might have to be some kind of response.
Yep. Well, it's their aim. That's absolutely their aim. Is to up the ante to a point where there's going to be no choice but a response.
Yeah, I think that's right. Except I don't actually have the ante up Yeah, they don't really have that much to up. I mean, obviously, at the moment, there's a lot of focused on, you know, the long-range drone warfare.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, all these, like, developments in Ukraine war have lost 4 or 5 years where, you know, there's an escalation on the Ukrainian side and on the side of their Western backers. They all tend to be signs of desperation and of weakness, yeah? You know, so, mm-hmm. so the current campaign, drone warfare campaign, is they have this idea that they can demoralize Russia, or they can wear it out, yes, and create a position where they can force it to come to terms that suit them. As far as I can see, that's a complete and utter fantasy.
There is no
basis for it whatsoever. So I don't think they have the ante to raise to actually, you know, to a sort of sufficient level that the Russian side is going to have to escalate. Putin's strategy, the Russian side seems to be doing, you know, what they're doing is advancing on the ground, to secure their objectives in relation to the Donbass, whilst at the same time conducting their own like long range strikes against Ukraine. Strikes, of course, and drone warfare, missile warfare, which are much more effective, much more extensive, much more impactful than anything the Ukrainians are doing to Russia at the present time.
Well, you know, I've got a time constraint. I know I've had you on for quite a while, but on a positive note, the whole concept of trying to wear Russians out, one only needs to look at Gorlovka as a prime example. Gorlovka, which is on the front lines, Gorlovka, which has not had water since 2014, 2015, because the Ukrainians keep hitting the water mains and the pumps with artillery or drones or missiles. Gorlovka's pre-war population was 380,000 people.
Right.
Gorlovka's present population is 320,000 people. They refuse to leave. It's their land. They're Russians. And, you know, my grandparents were born here, my great-grandparents, and the hell I'm going to leave. And
sure.
So, you know, you have people that have spent quite literally over a decade, 12 years under fire. They won't leave. I've been to Gorlovka more than a few times. You see burned out apartments where Ukrainians will fly in FPV drones up to an apartment building, look in the windows to see if they see people in there, and then ram that drone in there to blow up the apartment. You see burned out apartments like this. I've driven up and down the highway of death, which is basically the edge of the city, with drones taking out cars and artillery strikes. And the people there, and this is just a typical Russian mentality. This is our land. We're not going. That's it. Mm-hmm. You can kill me, but I'm not leaving. You can kill me, but you can't defeat me. That's the Russian mentality. You know, I may die, but I'm not going to be defeated. And defeat is stepping back.
It was the same spirit that defeated Nazi Germany.
Exactly.
The Great Patriotic War.
I mean, we've been invaded. People forget the first big invasion, pan-European invasion of Russia, was 1012 AD. Vyacheslav Khrabry, the Crown Prince of Krakow, and his Holy Roman Empire allies, German states. They grabbed Kiev. They pushed Vladimir Krasnosolnitsa out. They couldn't fix it. They couldn't hold it, though, and they got pushed back out. But after that, it was game on. There's very few countries in Europe that haven't had a shot at us at least once, or at least a coalition. Portuguese.
Russia has always survived, and I'm sure it will do so in the future. I only hope that we all survive with Russia, you know.
Yes. I'm not a big fan of throwing nuclear weapons around. If we can avoid that, that's kind of a
that would be
hard to fix issue right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was very, very hard to fix.
Yeah, you can rebuild after a conventional bomb. It's pretty damn hard to rebuild after a 50 megaton or 100 megaton or a kiloton or maybe a one megaton hole in the ground. So yeah, I prefer not to go down that road.
Sure. Me too.
So. Yeah, I've got kids. I want to see grandkids and great grandkids and so on, and not with two heads and three arms.
Right.
So
okay.
Thank you very much for joining.
Yes, optimistic note.
Yeah, on an optimistic note. Let's avoid all that.
Well, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you. And next time you're in Moscow, drop me a line.
I'll definitely come. I'll be back there in the next few months or so.
Sure. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, drop me a line. I will happily meet you.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Yep.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Thank you, everyone. Cheers.